And it's time now for the last episode in this week's series on the responsibility to protect, a norm that emerged as the world said never again to the genocides and conflicts of the 1990s.
The basic idea is protecting populations from mass atrocities and lying above all with the state. But if a state fails to protect its people, well, the international community should use appropriate means to do so. It is a norm which was agreed upon at the UN World Summit in 2005.
Monocle's Alice Block spoke to the international human rights lawyer Jared Genzer, the co-editor of The Responsibility to Protect, the promise of stopping mass atrocities in our time. He explained how R2P, as it's known, has evolved and made its mark.
The Responsibility to Protect has had an important impact. The problem is that people perceive it as being only the blunt-edged sword of military intervention, and that's really a very small percentage of what it is about. People see, you know, wrongly, I believe, Libya as a high watermark for the Responsibility to Protect, where there was an intervention to protect a civilian population in Benghazi, and the deadlock over Syria as a failure of the Responsibility to Protect, but neither of those assessments is actually fair or accurate. The Responsibility to Protect has worked quite nicely in countries like Kenya and Guinea and Liberia and a range of other places where major conflicts were potentially going to be undertaken. And it's also been really embraced by the international community across the board, even though, of course, there might be disagreement on how it's implemented.
Well, speaking of successes, here's Ban Ki-moon in early 2012 talking about the successes and the challenges of the norm.
We gave hope to people long oppressed in Libya, Cote d'Ivoire, South Sudan, Yemen, and Syria by our words and actions. We demonstrated that human protection is a defining purpose of the United Nations in the 21st century.
Jared, which of those cases there cited by Ban Ki-moon do you see as a good example of R2P in action?
They are both examples of successes as well as ongoing failures. But, you know, I would say, for example, looking at Syria, there's no doubt the Responsibility to Protect applies. However, the machinery of the UN was built to allow for a veto of permanent members of the Security Council. So it is actually not a failure of R2P, but a failure of the UN architecture, in my view, that has prevented meaningful engagement on Syria. I think if you look to a number of those examples, if you look to South Sudan, if you look to Cote d'Ivoire, you see low-profile examples where there hasn't been a lot of international attention, but where direct engagement by the international community early on in the form of diplomacy and serving as a bridge between warring parties has resulted in greater peace and stability being provided to those areas. Both countries have ongoing problems and challenges, as do others mentioned by the Secretary General. But it's actually, you know, much like a proverbial iceberg where 80% of it is underwater, or 90% is underwater. I would say that that is actually how one should evaluate the Responsibility to Protect. It's really not about the high-profile public examples of a Libya or a Syria that one measures.